keep everybody awake.
Chris. I don't know. We should put the thermals on, I suppose.
It's Wednesday, January 23rd. This is the Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing. Good afternoon. We are going to have some presentations today. Very appreciative of the time that you're giving us, and I'm hoping that you will remember to state your name for the record when you come to the table. And we're going to begin with our State Substance Abuse Strategy Program. It's a presentation that we expect to run. I'm hoping that we'll be able to keep the presentation within 45 to 50 minutes, so we have 10 minutes for questions. And I don't know if you all want to come up at the same time or how you want to approach this, but we'll begin. I have Commissioner Lucinda Jessen as first on the list, so we'll begin with Commissioner Jessen. Before you begin, I don't know how you've organized your presentation, but maybe this committee is an active committee, and when a question comes up sometimes, they want to ask it right when they want to ask it. And I'm okay with that if it doesn't throw our timing off. So do you have any advice for the chair about that?
Madam Chair, I'm Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. I think we are happy just to take questions as they come up. And our presentation will not be 45 minutes or anywhere close to that. I think we will be a little briefer. It will be more of an overview, similar to some of the overviews we've given when we've gone around the state. And I know that Senator Rosen joined us at one of those. You know, so I think questions just during as they come up would be perfect.
Oh, that's fabulous. I prefer that because it's more of an interaction and a dialogue that way. So thank you very much. You may begin.
Oh, good afternoon, and I'm so delighted that you invited us to come and do a short description of the first in the country statewide substance abuse prevention strategy. So what I thought I'd do is just explain why we thought starting down this road was a good idea, some of the initial work that's been done, and then really some of what we see going forward, because we really see the plan that hopefully you all have a copy of it as really a starting place. So that'll be my role, and then I will pass it off to my fellow commissioners to also kind of show about their part. What this really is, substance abuse, as so many of you all know, permeates much of the work of state government. There was, a study that was done at Columbia University, which certainly caught my eye, and it said that 15% of state government spending is attributable to addiction, mostly substance abuse. And that crosses every agency. And we all are working very hard to address that. But what we found is, and this is just in state government, and of course substance abuse affects so much more beyond state government, but we thought state government was a good place to start, because what we found was we had all of these different agencies doing good work in their silos, but not often working together. And sometimes identifying the same problems, but sometimes working on different problems. So what we did at the Department of Human Services, the legislature had asked us to look at a statewide substance abuse strategy. So and we called together the agencies that we thought were most directly involved. And that included not only the Department of Public Service and the Department of Public Health, and the three of us are here today, but we certainly have leadership roles. As most of you all know, DHS is the Substance Abuse Authority. That's our, in Minnesota when it comes to federal funding and other things. But we brought together not only our three agencies, but also education, the Department of Corrections, as we know that so much of what so many people in our correctional facilities have substance abuse problems, don't always get the treatment that they need. Also, Veterans Affairs, we know that that's a real issue for them. We also reached out to the courts. And asked our state court administrator's office to come together so that we could all both catalog what we were individually doing and see if we could set out goals and principles for our state government going forward. And that's what you see before you. I think it's we have kind of the short-term kind of strategy documents, but the lengthier strategy really gives you an overview of where we are with substance abuse in our state today, what we started doing about it, but also identifying some of the things we think are important to do going forward. I started out talking about the economic impact of substance abuse just on state government. But we know that's really just the tip of an iceberg. The real impact of substance abuse is it negatively impacts adolescent development, academic performance, employment, social relationships, and this is linked to increased crime, illness, child abuse, neglect, unwanted pregnancies, birth defects, injuries, crashes, accidental overdose deaths. It takes a real toll outside of the economic one on our state. Our thought was, as we came together, is that the very first step is state agencies and working with the courts, that we could be better aligned, that if we were identifying the same problems and we were working together, at least along, you know, aimed at this, we could eliminate duplication of effort on our messaging, because so much of this is about reaching people and doing kind of that public outreach. If we were working on it together and had the same messages, we would be more effective. So this is really a starting place for those efforts. And when we talked, we realized that from our perspectives, while we needed certainly to continue our law enforcement efforts to support the drug courts, which we have found, you know, so many people say are very effective, to support the multi-jurisdictional task forces that help interrupt this cycle of substance abuse, but primarily we realized we need a bigger focus on prevention. On that early intervention. We need to reach people before they hit that downward cycle of addiction and substance abuse that ends up destroying families and so many, and causes such health and legal problems. And we know, kind of based upon the work we have done together and looking at evidence-based practices, that there are things we can do earlier that work. And they're more effective if we're doing them together. So key in this strategy is, first, you know, let me mention a few things. Integration of addiction services with healthcare. I mean, I see this in my own agency at the department. We traditionally have had our chemical dependency, our substance abuse programming, in a, you know, it's a different administration, it's a different world than our healthcare system. You know, and we can do so much more if we integrate those services. And the three of us have been with others, as I mentioned, Senator Rosen joined us on one of these. We've been going around the state and holding meetings to learn from communities what's working in your community that we could build on and what's not working that we need to address. And certainly this integration between healthcare and our addiction services was one thing that came up again and again. It was interesting, even when we did the when we started these meetings, you would have kind of physicians and other healthcare providers kind of in a different, sitting in different parts of the audience even, than our CD counselors. And I think having that integration will be critical, and we heard a lot about that. We also need expanded support for recovery. You know, I think back to when I was in a very, one of those months I don't like to remember very much, but during the government shutdown. And I spent a lot of time before the special master, former Chief Justice Kathleen Blatz, trying to explain why certain DHS things we were doing should be essential services and funded during the shutdown. And one of the things I remember talking about was the need for recovery services, that was essential. You know, and she said, and I understood her reading of the law, that was, you know, looking at the law, you know, treatment was critical, but recovery support wasn't. It's like, well, but if you don't do recovery support, you just end up with people back into trouble and then back later into treatment. So I think certainly expanded support for recovery, and as well as just working to continuing to reduce the trafficking and sale of illicit drugs. Prevention, we know from studies that this type of prevention and early intervention work. There have been studies that say that every dollar we spend in school-based prevention and early interventions, which kind of gets at some of the school-based mental health grants we've been talking about. Every dollar we spend there saves an estimated $18 in subsequent problems that we as a state end up paying for. And that if you just look at it writ large, generally prevention, substance abuse prevention treatment yields a return of $12 in savings in drug-related crime and the criminal justice and health costs for a dollar we spend. So our priority in this, one of our priorities, is to really focus and figure out what works in prevention and early intervention and to promote that. you know, it certainly was helpful to me in putting together the governor's budget for the department that we just released yesterday. One of the things that we proposed to fund there is more training for Minnesota physicians. It's called ESPERT. We heard about it from the folks at Mayo, talked about kind of how this had really been working in their community, which is ESPERT stands for this screening, training the frontline, you know, physicians on how to do substance abuse screening, early intervention, and referrals. But we need to do more than just physicians. We need to really train the broad line of our healthcare professionals about prescription drug abuse, about treatment options for opiate addicts. And we also need, and this is one of the things that, you know, is set forth in the strategy, we need to accelerate efforts to increase participation by prescribers and pharmacies in our pharmacy monitoring program. So the physicians, before they're prescribing these opiates and other addictive medications, are able to check a database and understand if there is abuse going on. These are just a few things and a few of our initial ideas. I must say a lot of these, like in the ESPERT ones that I talked about, we have been in these hearings around Minnesota hearing more good ideas. We really see this document as a starting place, a framework to go forward, not only in state government, but we obviously want to take next steps to reach out to local law enforcement, to local government, to schools, and also to think about what we can do in the public relations area. You know, one of the immediate priorities we identified that we need to work on as a state is to really address the serious increase in prescription drug abuse and heroin we see in this state. And if you look at some of the charts in this, you'll see some of the lines for prescription drug abuse, for heroin use, arrests for heroin, really going up dramatically just in the last couple of years. We've seen some other addictions, you know, tapering off, which is really some good work. But this is an issue we really have to face in our state. And it's going to take more than just state government to do it, but we thought at least if we could come together as state government, identify this, start some of the kind of training and monitoring and discussions that we really need to have as a state to combat this problem. And I think when I go out and talk with, you know, with parents, with folks in the community, I think heroin, for an example, you know, that's something that a lot of people say, that's not in our neighborhood, that's not in our schools, that's someone else's children. And I think what we see, if you look at the numbers in this document, is that heroin is a major problem, an increasing problem across our state. And it's a problem in the suburbs, just like it's a problem in the cities. So I think part of what we need to do is start talking about this, figuring out how we move forward. And so with this, I'm happy to answer questions myself, turn it over to my colleagues who have more insights.
Thank you, Commissioner. Is Senator Rosen?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and good to see you again, Commissioner Jessen. If you wouldn't mind just stepping back and mentioning to the committee and the folks in the audience about your trips throughout the state, how many there were, the various locations, and my question would be: is did you learn anything differently in the meeting that we had that you had in Rochester that I attended versus one that you had in northwest corner of the state? Anything stark that we have to address because of regional differences or because it's a metro setting versus a greater Minnesota setting? Is there something you can address there?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I'm so glad you asked that question. There really were differences. You know, heroin was not as much of a problem in southwest Minnesota. You know, and my colleagues will jump in here if they want to add things, I'm sure, as well. But on the other hand, for example, we were in southwest Minnesota in Worthington. I think that was just in December. We're also in Duluth in November. We were also in Bemidji in November. And in Rochester,
December.
December.
Excuse me, Major.
So, once, for an example, what we found out was the synthetic drugs, bath salts, that sort of thing, very much an issue. If you talk to law enforcement and treatment providers in the Arrowhead region in Duluth, that's a problem there. When we went to Bemidji, I asked them about that, and they said, look, that's not really an issue here. But they were very concerned about methadone and saw that as a problem, kind of illegal trafficking of methadone as a problem in Northwest. You know, so those would be just a couple of examples. As I said, not as much a problem with heroin, but they're starting to see it in southwest Minnesota was identified in the other regions. You know, I would say what we did, just so that the committee is aware, on these trips, we the three of us and Commissioner Doman was with us for many of these trips, you know, we'd go, but we would get a group of local experts. So we would have someone from the medical community, someone from the city treatment community, local law enforcement. We usually had one of the judges who was working in the drug courts in that area. So we really had experts, and we had some folks from our tribes as well, you know, just talking about from their perspective, what were the bigger challenges, what was working. So we're meeting, actually, I think, just in another week to kind of try and take all those learnings to compile them to help us think about what we need to do in, as far as next steps.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Thank you. And that's what I found interesting at the Rochester meeting, Commissioner, is that the talk and the communication, collaboration afterwards, they did not want to leave. All these professionals from all these various factors were coming together, and they were talking and really breaking down, and perhaps some of the treatment modalities that were being used in Rochester have not necessarily hit the Bemidji or the Worthington area. So that was really fascinating to see, and I just remember when we were passing the meth bill, and Senator Jeff Michelle, of course it hit southern Minnesota very rapidly, very tough, and I remember him saying to me in caucus, he goes, well, what's the big deal about meth? And unfortunately, it hadn't hit the Edina or the Bloomingdale area. So when it hit hard. And that's what methadone, heroin, and all those issues are coming in. If we can be proactive, such as you have in this strategy, I think it's really the smart thing to do. I do have another question, and perhaps maybe this is for later, but on the pharmacy monitoring program, is that state funded? That's mostly federal funds. Is that correct on that one? Perhaps Commissioner Ellinger.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Yeah. Senator Rosen, the pharmacy monitoring actually comes out of the Board of Pharmacy. They oversee that, and they have been engaged with us in this initiative of trying to figure out all of the various points to intervene in their one. And I believe that they get some state funding for that, but I'm not 100% positive.
Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up on that pharmacy monitoring, is that a voluntary or is it mandatory? What's the status in Minnesota on that?
Please,
Madam Chair, Senator, it's my understanding that at this point in time, it's completely voluntary.
Just to follow up.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
I think some other states are looking at mandatory pharmacy monitoring, and I'm just wondering if you could shed some light on that and what that might look like in Minnesota, pros, cons.
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, you know, I'm not the expert. I mean, we have the Board of Pharmacy really has looked at some of these options, and other states have made it mandatory. I think that it's a matter of the balance. You know, we want to have as much reporting as possible so that it's a resource that, you know, physicians and pharmacists can rely upon before they dispense more, Oxycontin. Or Vicodin to people who may be drug seekers. On the other hand, we don't want to make it so onerous that we're just, you know, that every, it just adds, you know, two more steps to every single, you know, office visit for things that may be legitimate. So I think there's a balance there, and that's the challenge. But I think from our perspective, this needs to, if there's a spectrum from totally voluntary to, you know, mandatory and every single time, we need to move a lot more towards the mandatory end of the spectrum. Being, you know, cognizant of the realities of our healthcare delivery system.
Thank you, Commissioner. We're going to try to see if we can get some read on this from the Board of Pharmacy. I don't know if we've been able to find it yet, but as we talk about, if we're staying on the subject about steps that providers have to take in order to gather information, particularly in the area of prescription medication abuse, what is reasonable about this is that it's a simple matter of asking, because a person who is pursuing drugs will use multiple prescribers. And if the pharmacy, in an integrated way, can show what the patterns of use are in a person and reflect that back to a provider that says this person has used multiple providers, or let the person see, like a prescriber, that you can see, are you aware of how often that this has happened, or the length, or that this is not a best practice, or here's an alternative, that is a welcome resource to providers who are not by and large interested in creating addiction in their clients. So pursuing this, I think, is really a valuable part of an overall statewide strategy.
Madam Chair, yeah. and also Senator Nelson, I think the prescribing community really is on board with preventing prescription drug use. And as we expand our electronic health records and our interface of electronic health records, that is going a long way to make sure that within health systems they can identify where prescription drugs are being prescribed and who's using them and how they're being used, and they can monitor that. We really need to work to make sure that we have a statewide system with the electronic health records so we can do that. But there's sort of a conflict here, because we have this idea about pain. And we have pain specialists, and in fact, physicians are supposed to ask the patients, you know, how much pain are you having today? Is your pain under control? Then they really get criticized if people have too much pain. And so there's a balance of treating pain in an appropriate fashion and over-treating and have it being used. And there are individuals who misuse drugs, and so there's a fine balance, to, as Commissioner Jessen said, to be over-prescriptive, pardon the pun, on what we do to let things slide. So it is a balance that I think the medical community across the state have been really working on and trying to find ways to best balance that.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm going to have Ms. Cavanaugh articulate what the language reads about this.
Madam Chair and members, this program, it is mandatory. The dispensers are required to submit certain information to the board of pharmacy, the name of the prescriber, the name of the dispenser, the prescription number, the name of the patient for whom the prescription was written, the address, the date of birth, the date the prescription was filled, the name and strength of the controlled substance, that sort of thing. There are some limitations of what the board can do with that data. Basically, it's more law enforcement type usage. And for the funding, I think they started with federal grants, and then it's now a fee system where they do get a portion of the fee that's paid through certain health-related licensing board occupations, board of medical practice, nursing, dentistry, podiatric medicine, optometry, and pharmacy all pay a certain amount of their fees goes to administer this program to the Board of Pharmacy.
Thank you, Senator Rosen.
Would it be possible? I know that SAMHSA used to have some money for this. Is that correct, Commissioner? I believe so. And it would be interesting to see if there is any more money, because this is an important part. This monitoring program and getting it right is a very important part to our tool of combating
toolbox. Yeah,
our toolbox, right?
Yeah, I would just editorialize it, maybe overexposing my attitudes about these things, but something like this program that would ask prescribers to take an extra step in order to understand the prescribing patterns they have or the use patterns of their clients. If there's objections or resistance to that, I think that the main way that you deal with addiction or substance abuse at all, in the same way that we dealt with the smoking cessation, when you know that there's a cost driver to the well-being of the community and to the economy, you have to take a look at the enabling system or the system that surrounds that allows it to happen. So when we put forward things that break up the enabling system, you will hear people object to the extra step they have to take or this or that, And we have to be careful to understand that while that sounds like it's legitimate, it should be looked at in the context that these are the systems, if we don't clean them up, that enable the continuation of whether it's prescription drug use or other kinds of chemical use. And the true intervention in all of this that's real prevention is busting up the enabling system. So I'm listening closely for what strategies there are, not just in providing more treatment or follow-up care so there's less preventing recidivism. I think that's fabulous. But I'm interested in there being a deliberate effort in our statewide plan to address those things that are substantive supporting systems to the addict in the continuation of addiction. So that's a little editorial coming from me. And I have a background in this area. I want you to know that in my healthcare practice. And this is coming from an understanding of how difficult it is to intervene in families and individuals with this problem, and that the biggest difficulty is busting up the enabling system. Thank you. Commissioner, did you want to respond to that?
Madam Chair, I appreciate your comments, especially given your expertise in this area. If I could just once again say, we see this as a framework, you know, and so that's why as a first step towards having a statewide strategy, and that's why we are seeking guidance from others, and certainly you all have a great deal of expertise, so we appreciate the comments.
Thank you. Any other questions for Commissioner Jessen? Okay, Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health. I want to respond first to Senator Rosen's comment. I was not able to be at the Rochester session. I was at all of the other ones. And there were some similarities in all of the places that I went. The similarities were that the community was really concerned about the issue of substance abuse. And they were all surprised at how many other sectors were interested in substance abuse. And I think in all of these sessions, they recognize we have a lot of community partners that are there to work with. And I think sometimes there were new partners that they weren't aware of in their community. And although the substance that was discussed at the various places may have been a little bit different, there was a general consensus that this was an issue that we all had to address as a community. And I do think there was one that came forward at all, and I think has to be our knowledge, is that, you know, we talk prescription drug abuse has been an increasingly important one, but the biggest problem we have is alcohol. And you talk about enabling systems. The price of alcohol is very low, and I think our strategy says one of the strategies is to really have a serious discussion about increasing the price of alcohol, because it has been demonstrated that it's a very elastic product, and higher the price, particularly for young folks, that it has a deterrent effect by doing that. But also what came from all of these is that when we looked at the principles that were behind putting this strategy together, I think there was general consensus in the community that those principles are what we need to use to move forward in developing some of the actual interventions. And the principles are of collaboration. As Commissioner Jessen said, there are several state agencies that have to be engaged in this. With DHS as the lead substance abuse agency, we need to come into partnership with it. And she mentioned the agencies. But certainly the private sector community also has to be engaged. And we heard that loud and clear throughout the state, that collaboration really is what's necessary. We have some great cylinders of excellence, but we have to cross those boundaries and really work collaboratively. We also have to think about prevention and early intervention. A lot of our work has been early identification and intervening when somebody has a problem. But there are a lot of primary prevention things that we can do. And certainly one of the things that we as an agency are thinking about as we think about our statewide health improvement program, which is working in communities throughout the state, that we can start to work on some of the substance abuse prevention, because it is a population issue. It is a public health issue, because it affects everybody in the community. It affects everybody in this state. And these are things that actually there are prevention strategies that work. And just mentioning the fact that substance abuse affects everybody in this state, alcohol by itself causes about $5.3 billion worth of costs in this state that really are not covered by the alcohol taxes that are on that product. So prevention and early intervention are really important, and we need to build that into our systems. that we also have to think about health disparities. We're reducing disparities when it comes to substance abuse, because there are particular populations that respond differently to different chemicals, and use of chemicals are different in different places. There's an urban, suburban, rural differences in various chemicals. There are income differences that we have to pay attention to. So I think one of the things in the state, we have to think about disparities in health outcomes, and that has to be one of the focus issues that we have. And along with that, we have to think about the cultural competence of what we do with our substance abuse prevention and intervention programs, because there are some cultural differences in how chemicals are thought about and used. We have to have a continuum of services. It's one of the principles that we really need to think about this through the entire system, our environment within the state. And we also have an integrated approach, as Commissioner Jessen said. We really need to make sure that we have integration of medical care, public health, social service, law enforcement, the judicial system, corrections, all have to be part of this, because it, as public health, as I mentioned to you, this committee and talking about public health is what we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. This problem will not be resolved by one agency working independently. It is a collaborative effort that needs to be there. And so that integration, and I think that's why when we think about health reform, we have to think about not only building in early intervention and treatment as part of our medical care system, but we have to say, how do we do the primary prevention that goes along with that? How do we make sure that all of those services are supported in our health reform system? And certainly from my perspective as the Commissioner of Health, one of the areas that we have to really focus on in addition to the primary prevention is the data collection. And that's why I think the prescription drug use database is really important. But we need to have a system of collecting and analyzing the information. We certainly have the student survey. We have the behavioral risk factor surveillance system, a variety of systems that we have to collect information. But we have to make sure that those data systems are collecting the right information, analyzing the right way, and get that information out to folks so that we can have really a data-driven approach to substance abuse. And so, as Commissioner Jessen said, this is a first step. It really highlights some of the principles. It highlights some of the initial activities that we can. But it certainly is a nice blueprint for how we as state agencies, in collaboration with our local partners throughout the state, can move forward from this point on.
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. Commissioners, welcome. I want to applaud you for a comprehensive approach, or at least a collaborative approach to chemical health issues that are kind of near and dear to my heart. I did want to ask a question, Commissioner Ellinger, as you talked about the kind of culturally specific cultural competency disparity issue as it relates to this issue. One of the things that have come up in the community is, how do we define what a culturally specific and or competent chemical abuse organization is? And I'll just give you a primer of that. So there are a lot of people of color who enter our system, but not a lot of agencies that consider themselves of that particular culture. So how do we define that in ensuring that people are getting the treatment, the culturally specific or culturally competent treatment that they need? And then in addition to that, I know we fund that and we give a little extra dollars for organizations that say that they're culturally specific. So could you kind of help me understand that? I've been asking that question and I haven't gotten a good answer yet.
Commissioner Ellinger, are you wanting to take that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, I will start with that, and then I will defer also to Commissioner Jessen, who has some role certainly to play in this. But I think when I talk about it from the public health perspective, first of all, we have to engage communities into identifying what the problems, how they see the problems in their community, whether it be in a county or in a city or on a reservation. How they frame that, how they believe that, because a lot of the mindset of how we intervene as a society comes from the cultural beliefs about and the use of chemicals. Certainly, like dealing with the American Indian community and tobacco, there are some certain cultural issues that really we have to pay attention to. So, first of all, is how do we engage the community in a dialogue? And for me, how do we engage the community to say what are the prevention activities that the community can embrace that they want to implement in dealing with these issues, which is affecting everybody in their community? I think the prevention or the actual intervention is more in the realm of what Department of Human Services does. But we need to find ways, with the help of community leaders, to say, who do we need to talk to find out what is the perspective of drugs, how they see it as an issue. Do they own this issue as something that the community as a whole wants to deal with? Because it is going to take a community commitment to deal with all of the, be it tobacco, be it alcohol, be it prescription drug use. The community has to say, this is an issue that we're going to partner with the professionals, but also with the community agencies to deal with this. And then the intervention, I think I'll let that to Commissioner Jessen to respond to.
Commissioner Jessen?
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden. I think we need to do a better job measuring the outcomes, including for our treatment, the treatment providers that provide chemical dependencies treatment and recovery and other services than we do today. And one of the outcomes we need to measure is also the kind of the reductions in disparities. That's something that's not, you just don't flip a switch and do that. But I think now we are focused too much on, yes, we pay for this, but do we look at our providers and say who's getting better outcomes, measure the outcomes and determine which ones are better. We need to be doing that across the board with providers. We need to particularly do that with providers that are working, with populations where we have the biggest health disparities. Certainly with our American Indian communities, we need to focus on that work there particularly. And that's one where I know where there's, a lot of good evidence that if you're working with culturally sensitive providers, that, people in our CD treatment programs who are American Indians are, they're more successful. So we need to do a better job identifying those and, funding those programs. We recognize that. We're in a starting place. I think having culturally specific providers is important. I think, though, if we focus on the outcomes, including those reductions in disparities, is critical.
So, Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, just a moment, Senator Hayden. I want to give Commissioner Dahman a chance to get her piece in. We talked about how we weren't going to go that long here, but we are. So, Senator Hayden and then Senator Nelson, and then I'd like to give the Commissioner a chance to put her part in. Senator Hayden.
So, I guess just to follow up, I think that this kind of realm is something that we really need to have a thorough conversation about. So with all due respect to both of you guys, this isn't kind of a starting place, right? This is we have policies in place, we have enhanced rates, we have outcomes that we look at. Now, I think this would be something that says we might need to do better, but once again, I think that there may be issues in the community relative to how we engage communities of color on these particular issues. And I know you guys have been around long enough to see it, and there's one consistent theme in this legislature is this issue about disparities. And so what I would hope we would do, Madam Chair, at some point, and I can, of course, have as many offline conversations as we can with the commissioners, but I do think that this is something that we really have to dig deeply into, and with all due respect to the commissioners, and I know that they see things at a very high level and have a lot of responsibilities, we really need to get the people who are responsible for initiating these programs and thoroughly figure out what we're doing. I'll give you a last example. The issue of if you have 80% of your clients are African American, does that make you a culturally specific agency? Or if your organization is a culturally specific agency that's run by African Americans, does that make you a culturally specific agency? I haven't been able to get the answer to that question yet, and I think it needs to be answered. So I won't take up much more of your time, the committee's time, Madam Chair, today, but I really do think it's something that we have to really stop, park, and do a deep dive to figure out what's happening here, because the outcomes aren't matching, and I don't know why, because I can't get a definitive answer on what a culturally specific strategy is.
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, I will go back and ask questions to try and get you the answer to that, and we're happy to talk with you. I think I've said several times, maybe before you came in, this is a starting place for a conversation, and that's really what we're trying to do with this framework document. But one of the big issues we know that is out there is we do not have enough providers in the CD world who come from diverse backgrounds. we have to address that. And I think that's one of the recommendations of the Health Reform Task Force. You know, we can't do this. It doesn't all happen overnight. But that is a big part of, I think, what the challenge is here.
Senator Nelson, and then we'll move to the Department of Safety.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still thinking about this pharmacy monitoring, and if it might be something that maybe I need a side story on, or maybe something the committee might be more interested in at a later time. But just thinking about the balance that you talked about, Commissioner Jessen, and not putting unnecessary hurdles in front of effective and efficient health care, I understand that. And I also understand the importance of the electronic medical records, and I see where that might be the solution to getting that monitoring in an effective and efficient way. So my question, Commissioner Ellinger, is, so what's the status of our electronic medical records in Minnesota now, and how far are we from being able to use them to adequately monitor opiates and other type of addictive drugs in the prescribing realm?
And Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, actually, Minnesota is a leader, and actually we're the number one state in terms of e-prescribing and also in implementation of electronic health records. So we're farther along. There's still the integration of some of those is still an issue that we're working on. We have a e-health advisory committee that's working on that, and prescription drugs and drug monitoring is one of those issues that is on their plate. I can't tell you when, you know, we will have that resolved, but it is certainly one of those priority areas that we're working on.
Thank you.
Okay, let's give, is it Jerry Boisvert from the Department of Public Safety and Director of the Office of Justice Programs?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I apologize for not introducing myself before when I incorrectly answered your question, Senator Nelson. I just wanted to make a brief comment to, I'm representing Commissioner Doman here today to let the committee know how supportive we are of this effort. Obviously, DPS has long recognized that substance abuse impacts every part of our division as well as all the people we serve as well. Whether we're talking about impaired driving or the role substance abuse plays in domestic violence and child abuse, the crime and violence that are associated with obtaining, using, and distributing drugs. Many of us, including Senator Rosen, have been here working hard to address these issues for many, many years and in collaboration with one another. But this framework provides us a new opportunity to look at it from a holistic perspective. In terms of one of our silos of excellence, which I think public safety is, we provide funding for 24 violent crime task forces around the state who really are comprised of 200 investigators with 115 police agencies. And last year, they made 3,522 arrests. But any law enforcement agent will tell you that you cannot arrest your way out of this problem. It is one of the tools. We know that obviously the issues of substance abuse go well beyond breaking the law, so our office, the Office of Justice Programs, has been funding primary and or secondary and tertiary prevention and intervention programs for kids who are already engaged in the system. We have a very soft spot in our heart for intervening with young people to turn around the problems of addiction. We also support treatment in the prison. We give Department of Corrections funding for treatment in a prison environment. We also have other kinds of state treatment grants. And we also, in collaboration with the Office of Traffic Safety and state courts, support drug courts, which we think are one of the most effective interventions. And we heard that. I was able to go on two. Commissioner Doman was not able to attend the northern visits, and I was able to attend those and listen. And it was loud and clear where we went that drug courts are really an effective strategy, and every community ought to have it across the board. Obviously, with our Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, we do a significant amount of intervention in the illegal activity. But I think that ours, looking forward to the opportunity to connect the dots between our agencies and the other state agencies, will provide us an opportunity to actually alleviate the pain caused to families, individuals, and communities. And we look forward to continuing our work with our colleagues from other agencies. And thank you for this opportunity to represent public safety.
Thank you. Thank you. Then we have some more time for questions. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's more just a statement that Commissioner Jessen was saying that this is a framework, and I truly believe it is because you never know what's going to be the next drug of choice. You never know what's coming down the pipeline. It's, and so if you have the framework, you can adjust it. If you have the, that collaborative, the agencies having a collaborative agenda going forward, that's going to be able to be nimble and adjust to the next big crisis, work on alcohol along with that. I think that's really important, Commissioner Ellinger. So I thank you for doing this. I think it's important to be the leader again in our the way we approach these issues.
Thank you. Commissioner, any of you, are these interventions that we're talking about developing as a statewide substance abuse strategy, are they implementable within your organizations, or should we be looking forward to some specific legislation? What can you do within your own sphere of influence without legislative interaction, and what will be coming forward for us legislatively? Whomever would like to, Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, maybe I could take a first stab at this. I think it's really a collection of things. You know, we just finished these statewide meetings. We're meeting week after next to identify what we learned from those meetings, you know, and from our other outreach. Commissioner Ellinger and I, for an example, we're just meeting with the University of Minnesota Medical School and their health systems, you know, to get their input. So we've been doing a lot of outreach. So we're going to be putting together really kind of a next document kind of coming out of our meeting. And we have our staff across all of these agencies meeting on a monthly basis to kind of get to also, you know, be working levels below us on this as well. So I'll have a better answer for you, you know, after those next meetings. But I would anticipate that some of them are things we can do ourselves. You know, we, like at the Department of Human Services, we do fund a lot of these programs. We do a lot of prevention funding at DHS. But if we can align some of that with what the Department of Health is doing. We can refocus it. So there's some resources we already have that we can realign and use. There's some things, though, that I think we will need legislative support for. As I think I mentioned earlier, this was helpful hearing folks in Rochester were saying that made me really seriously when we're looking at how to reallocate dollars and what to focus on in the governor's budget for the Department of Human Services. I made sure that we proposed funding this ESPERT program, $600,000 a year, but people in Rochester said it made a huge difference. So I think it's a combination. I think on the policy perspectives, on the prescription monitoring program, that is one where I think there will be legislation proposed. That's one where we're going to have to work, though, closely with the pharmacy board, and I would expect them to be leading that, but, you know, getting input from us all. So I think it will really be a combination.
Thank you. Would anybody else like to speak to that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I certainly concur with Commissioner Jessen. There are a lot of things that we can do just, I think, by putting a focus on this. I think the medical community, the law enforcement community, the judicial community, the human service said, all right, let's refocus. You know, look at what we're already doing and how can we refocus some of our efforts and who are our new partners. And I think we can start doing some of those collaborative things without many changes that need to occur. But certainly, as we start to do that, we will run into some roadblocks where we will need either some more resources or some legal authority to do some of the things. So I think it's a continuum. And as was pointed out, there will always be a drug of choice. There will always be, you know, the human condition is one where there things will pop up and substances will be used. So we need to have this as to be an ongoing effort and always reevaluating sort of continuous improvement on how we do it. This is a first step, good collaboration, things that we can implement now. We got some ideas about the next steps that we will take, and then we will keep you informed about where we go after that.
Commissioner Ellinger, would you, I really want to emphasize the issue that Senator Hayden is asking, that we get a clarification about what it is that we're talking about as an intervention to address the reality that there are disparities, not just here in lots of places, but we hear this kind of talk about disparities and the data is presented to demonstrate it, but there's really, I did hear reference to the idea of making certain that our provider system is reflective of the community that's being served and understands the culture through which the person is living and viewing the world in addressing addiction. But, you know, more clarity about what that means, what the analysis is for the when we do bills, which I call interventions, they really get directed at what we're thinking out of a certain perspective are the drivers of the problem. And we are not getting good outcomes in health disparities, which means we are looking through the wrong lens at what's driving the issue. So I'm looking forward to this, not just conversation, but initiatives. You know, I love the word conversation. I love having conversations. But at some point, I think we ought to be doing something. And I think that Senator Hayden is frustrated with that, too. And then the other for Commissioner, would you say to me, would you articulate in relationship to what you're trying to put forward in a substance abuse strategy for the state? What, because I heard the term prevention being described, and there's first, second level, third level of prevention. Much of it is to prevent recidivism or to prevent duplication of resources and to integrate the resources for better impact. But I think those are important. I don't want to dismiss that. This is a continuum, and we have a problem that is creating all sorts of difficulties in our communities. The impact that I hear you talking about is the negative impact of crime, for example, or of assault. But I'm talking about, when I'm talking about intervention at the prevention level, it's at an enabling system level. And has there been any discussion about that? Or can you, as the Commissioner of Health, I know you're committed to prevention, which is before there's a victim, you know, what it is that we are doing to break up that system out of which, it's like a petri dish, out of which this grows. And what are we doing to make sure that we're impacting that petri dish?
Madam Chair, you had two questions. The first about disparities. We don't have the answers for reducing health disparities, but we have identified that they're a huge problem. For us to really get our hands around that, how to best do it, we need to be able to engage with communities of color and American Indians throughout the state to really have a dialogue where they are in partnership with us in trying to identify the problem, clarify the problem, and identifying how to intervene. There are some things we can do on the professional side. We have to have providers better reflect the communities that are served. But we're working on that. We know that that's part of the solution, but really the solution will come from some conversations with the communities themselves and the leadership in those communities. So we really are looking at that's what we're trying to do with community engagement, and that's the approach we're taking at the health department to do that. Second piece related to prevention. There are primary prevention, and I just want to use one example that you should think about in terms of primary prevention. What have we done with tobacco? Tobacco, you know, we used to have over 50% of folks smoking tobacco, a huge problem. We increased the price. We eliminated marketing of tobacco to vulnerable populations. We stopped promotions of tobacco industry. We put limits on where they could be sold. We did a whole lot of things and a lot of education that really reduced it. These were primary prevention activities. Think about what could be done with alcohol, which is the leading substance abuse problem. Alcohol is cheaper now than it has ever been in the state. It is cheaper than bottled water. It is marketed to adolescents and young adults. It is linked with professional and college sports so that it's normalized as it. There are drink specials that reduce the price. It is marketed. It is pervasive in our. There are things that we can do to reduce that kind of activity. Those are the kinds of prevention things that we need to consider. And similarly with other kinds of substances, we need to think that kind of upstream, increasing the price, decreasing availability, decreasing the visibility, and decreasing the normative behavior that they have that comes from that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for that. I don't know what happened, but this is just kind of a... I'm from Colorado originally, and I was just out there for December for Christmas, and they are having some real issues with this legalizing marijuana. So I'm not sure where we're going to go with medical marijuana or what's going to happen in the state with that. But commissioners, look out, you know, because they are really struggling out there with that.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Senator Rosen, my colleagues throughout the country, commissioners of health, where they have legalized medical marijuana, it is a nightmare for them, let me tell you. I'm hoping that I don't have to deal with that.
I hope so, too.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation today. Looking forward to having more come before us in this regard. And at some point when we have the Board of Pharmacy here, let's remember to ask questions about the program that they're really responsible for. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Okay, thank you very much. And now we're going to move to the overview of Reform 2020. We had some presentations on this in the Budget Committee today, but not everyone who is here is on the Budget Committee. And I think it deserves more time. There's a great deal of policy proposed in this legislation. So with us is Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner Dave Hartford, and Assistant Commissioner Aaron Sullivan. Aaron Sullivan Sutton.
Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner Aaron Sullivan Sutton will not be joining us. She's in another hearing.
Okay,
today,
great.
So the two of us.
That's the two of you. Will there be no presentation then on Children and Family Services today?
I will be, Madam Chair, I'll be presenting the housing proposal that's part of Children and Family Services.
Great. Thank you. And who will begin? Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, I will begin the discussion on Reform 2020. Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Human Services for Continuing Care. I believe you have a PowerPoint presentation that will guide our discussion. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Reform 2020 was an initiative that grew out of a bipartisan desire to look at our Medicaid program and look for ways to redesign it. And the goals were quite specific and asked us to look at a number of parts of our system and try to address the pressures that we know are coming on our long-term care and health systems. We identified some objectives for the Reform 2020. We wanted to deliver better individual outcomes. We wanted to assure the right service at the right time in the right place. And again, we wanted to ensure the sustainability of our system of supports and services. Some of the values that we've attempted to demonstrate within the Reform 2020 initiative is community inclusion, person-centered services, self-direction and choice, independence and recovery, individual planning and quality outcomes. So we want to emphasize community settings. We really want to build upon our national reputation for really having a very solid home and community-based system. And I'll remind the committee that we were ranked number one in the country by the Commonwealth AARP scoreboard on long-term care services and support in 2011. And it had a number of domains that evaluated each of the states, and Minnesota came out on top. For background, we have a well-developed home and community-based services system. 94% of individuals with disabilities live in the community rather than institutions. And on the senior side, 61% of individuals on our public programs live in the community versus institutions now. That's not 61% of our seniors, 61% of where our public services are going. We've had five long-standing waivers that we've partnered with the federal government to help move people into the community rather than rely upon an institutional-based system. We have successfully transitioned away from very restrictive care settings for people with mental illness. Dave will talk a little bit about ANOCA in a little bit, but just as a reference, ANOCA has transformed from 250 beds a decade ago to six very specialized acute care hospital units with 110 beds. That's the last of our regional treatment centers in the state. Other states look to us for how have we been able to accomplish this, and are very, in some cases, envious that we've been able to make the kind of transition to home and community-based services. But we always need to improve, and that's what this initiative is about. Now, let me comment. Reform 2020 has kind of become a brand, and it means different things to different people. So this will talk about a lot of elements of Reform 2020, a subset of are submitted to the federal government for waiver approval, but not all of it. We'll try to distinguish the differences, because some of the things are simply modifying the way we do business today to update it and make it more effective for today and for 2020. We are certainly not in any way, shape, or form trying to limit. In fact, we're trying to enhance choice for our older Minnesotans and persons with disabilities. And much of what you will also hear today, some of you heard this morning, you'll hear more of it tomorrow morning, which is part of the governor's budget, where we need authority.
Assistant Commissioner, maybe I'll just throw this question at you. This waiver that's being sought, the 1115 waiver you're referring to, is that correct?
Correct.
That asks for further flexibility to achieve these objectives. Do you intend to move the legislation that's the part of this reform 2020 that needs legislative intervention before we know if we have approval from the federal government, and have the legislation passed based on the assumption or based on the condition, I guess you'd say, that the waiver would pass?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we are moving the Reform 2020 initiative as constructed. Concurrently, we're in discussions with the federal government. We've advised the federal government of the legislative time frame in Minnesota, and they've not committed to necessarily completing it in concurrence with our timeline, but they've expressed an interest in trying to be as supportive as possible.
Assistant Commissioner, does it mean then that that we pass it and those components that are in here that need federal waiver would be implemented at the time the waiver is approved, or if it is approved, or will we be looking for alternative strategies to implement this without the waiver?
Madam Chair, it is very possible that sometime during mid to later on in the session, we will have to develop contingencies around federal approval and different language to implement upon federal approval. The complexity of the effort is we're really trying to shift resources around. We're trying to enhance federal participation in some of our state-only funded program, which allows us to accomplish some of these reforms. And so to the extent that the budget decisions influence what we're able to accomplish is the complexity of trying to get as much feedback and as much assurance from the federal government in order to make those decisions. I don't think the policies of what we're trying to do will be subject to a lot of modification, but we're going to have to perhaps prioritize in a different way based upon the reaction of the federal government.
So for the purposes of this committee, we can expect that we will be reviewing the changes that you're making here in policy, and that's not dependent on what happens at the federal government for waiver. We will look at that. We will review this that you're presenting to us, primarily the policy changes here today on Reform 2020.
I'm sure that's correct.
That's why I think it's important that we hear this and understand what the elements are of this proposal.
Very good. I'm on the slide 4 or page 4 now. What we've identified is there are critical junctures that people face in their lives that we can have the most impact, the most influence. And so a lot of what we're trying to accomplish here within this reform package is to identify those and actually seek earlier interventions. Let me give you some examples. The alternative care program, for example, is a state-funded program that helps people remain in their homes using state funds. It prevents or delays the exhaustion of resources for private paying individuals, those who are not on our public programs, on medical assistance yet. And it helps them do so by giving them some modest support. We believe, and we've documented, that it saves the state money by helping people stay off of medical assistance. We've now included that in the waiver request and asked the federal government to participate in that program because if it saves the state money, it is concurrently saving the federal government money by keeping people off of medical assistance. So that is part of the waiver request. There are a number of initiatives in here where if we interact earlier, we'll talk a little bit about housing stabilization services, the Anoka Regional Treatment Center initiative, a number of those critical points in time that if we can get better, we can actually improve the lives of the individuals as well as manage our resources more effectively. So turning to slide 5, one of the principles, values around Reform 2020 is really putting consumers in the driver's seat. We want our older adults and our people with disabilities to be in control of the decision-making around their lives. So we want to promote that choice. The Community First Services and Supports demonstration, which is part of the governor's budget, does exactly that. It really is the next generation of our PCA program, which allows people to have more control over the design and the services that are being provided to support them in the community. And we want to demonstrate that that can be done in a very cost-effective manner. The PCA program is one of our lower-cost supports for people living in the community currently. The transition supports demonstration, again, helping to build upon the Return to Community initiative, where we've assisted people, again, private-paying individuals, people who are not yet impoverished, to help them return to the community to preserve their assets and live in an environment that they prefer is really a key ingredient to how we manage the totality of our long-term system and supports. We have presented on Reform 2020 over 70 times. This is just a continuation of the public discussion about what our long-term system and supports ought to look like in Minnesota. We have held large public hearings. We have had engaging feedback from what communities and individuals liked about the Reform 2020 draft. We've had written comment periods where people can post their comments, and that's part of the process. We've gone through two of those phases. We then submit it to the federal government, and they've had a federal opportunity for people to weigh in. So there's been a lot of public participation, and this is, again, just a continuation of that. We've worked through a lot of existing work groups. We've created new work groups that are specifically targeted to some of these initiatives. I want to draw your attention to slides 7 and 8. This was a way that we we tried to depict what is it we're trying to achieve in our long-term system and supports. The conceptual framework, the home and community-based system right now, is the inverted pyramid, where the desire of most, if not all, of people who are seeking long-term services and supports is to gain access to one of our waivers, one of our five waivers. The elderly waiver, the community alternative for disabled individuals, the developmental disability waiver, the CAC or the community alternative waiver, or the brain injury waiver. That has been the goal from a consumer standpoint. Get into the waiver, and then you are assured that broad menu of services. And we know that there are waiting lists on two of those waivers to manage the resources that are available. So we're trying to change the expectation, though, that the waiver is not the only way to receive services and supports.
Assistant Commissioner, excuse me for interrupting. If I were to summarize this, you're saying that the waiver system as it is now, we really like the waiver system because it allowed flexibility and you didn't have to move into higher level, could stay in the community, you wouldn't have to go into an institution. But now you're taking a look at the fact that the waiver requires, no matter what your level of need is, the waiver is the same for what it provides for you, and that the opportunity that you're going to be talking about in the next page is to how to be more flexible around using those resources. Senator Hoffman has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm how appropriate. I agree the flexibility of the waiver is important. And I'm wondering, Assistant Commissioner Coleman, how are you going to track? For years, Minnesota would do a report on how many people were on waivered services waiting list. And we know specifically within certain communities that that's a lot of people. And so I'm wondering how, if you're talking about outcomes, which you are, how are we going to measure those outcomes when we no longer are reporting how many people are on waivered services? So can you help me understand how that's going to work?
Madam Chair, Senator.
Assistant Commissioner.
This does not suggest that we're not going to continue to track individuals who still may be in need of services. But what we're trying to do is be more flexible in our total system. People oftentimes need a specific service in one of our waiver programs. They don't need it all, but they have to get into the waiver program in order to access that specific service. That doesn't seem to be as efficient as we could be. So if we can have a system where the broader menu, the waivers, can address those with the more complex needs that need that kind of system, but that the participation can flex based upon the individual's needs, and not everyone needs the higher cost waiver system, we can do better with what we have. It still may mean, depending upon how this is constructed, that some people may need to be on a waiting list, but we think it's a prime strategy to deliver services so people wouldn't have to be on a waiting list. Let me make one more comment. Individuals on waiting lists are still receiving services. They still are receiving services such as personal care attendance services or things of that nature. You don't have to be in the waiver to receive state plan services. But this is a way to reshape the expectations and get services to people earlier. But we would still track people who are not receiving what they need at that particular time.
Senator Hoffman.
We would be evaluated on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just follow up. I have lots of questions, but I'm going to be brief. And when you're talking about outcomes and goals, yet you don't have a baseline, and we come back to measure what the need is for the state, we know folks usually waiting for waiver services are getting some other supports, whether it be PCA or you might be on a, you know, TEFRA or you might be on whatever. But still, I'm having a hard time really understanding just, you know, how are you going to make the connections when we're not still looking at the need that's out there? So, and it's just more of a comment. I'd like to see that back in place, Madam Chair, and then I'll let you finish your report, Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, Senator,
Commissioner.
Let me take another stab at that. And we'll drift into another initiative called Min Choices, which is a comprehensive assessment of an individual's needs, their desires, their life goals, et cetera. We currently have multiple assessment tools for our various programs. This is a single assessment tool that will apply to all of our long-term services and supports individuals. That will document for the first time in a comprehensive way what the needs are, what the goals are of those individuals, whether you're a younger adult or an older adult. So then we will have a better database of how well are our services matching up to the expressed needs and the choices that people want to have. So it's another tool to try to manage that. I was also just given a note that the most recent version of the Biennial Disability Services Report just came out. So it is available now, and we can make sure that everyone gets a copy of that biennial report. And it does illustrate the waiting list and some of those questions that you've posed.
Please continue. I'd like to make sure that we get everybody a chance to talk. So if you can summarize the highlights for us.
Okay. On page 9, I jumped ahead a little bit. It talks about the universal assessment, some of the other initiatives that are not specifically part of Reform 2020 but are critically needed in order for Reform 2020 to be successful, the integration of health and long-term care, the standards, the disability waiver rate systems, and you'll be hearing more about those in the coming weeks, and the money follows the person demonstration, which is soon to be implemented and move more people into settings of their choice. The first strategy, improving navigation and streamlining access, first contact simplification, very briefly, we have pre-admission screening, we have long-term care consultation, we have all sorts of strategies to help people gain information with which to make good choices. And we're trying to modify that, transition that over the coming years, and that is part of the governor's budget to simplify that, have our linkage lines do some of the initial screening of consultation, allow counties and agencies do the more face-to-face long-term care consultation. So there's a series of strategies. We want to develop a home and community-based report card. We, again, want to be measured. How well are we doing? How well are our providers doing? And foundational to that is a consumer experience survey where we actually ask the program participant, what do you think about the services that you're receiving? Are they allowing you to meet your goals? We want to target employment supports, particularly to transition age youth, people who are 18 to 26. We want to leverage what we've learned about how to support young people to gain employment and maintain their employment. And we've had some demonstration grants to, in fact, do so. We want to simplify vulnerable adult reporting to a single toll-free statewide number so that we can all know how to report where we see circumstances for adults who we may think are being abused or not cared for in a proper fashion. Strategy 2, redesigning and improving services, planning and service development. Again, we are planners. We do a lot of planning, but most of the planning occurs at the local level. We do gaps analysis, and we're doing both older adult and services for people with disabilities gaps analysis at the county level to tell us what are the services that people in your communities need that don't currently exist. We also want to do a critical access study for home community-based services. The services may be available, but if people can't access them for a particular reason, we want to know that. I'm trying to hit the highlights here. We've got some mental health redesign that Dave's going to talk about. We want to address some housing service supports and homelessness. So housing stability services on, I guess it's slide 12, and this is where Aaron Sullivan Sutton would be presenting, so I'm going to try to share what she's attempting to do there. This is a service. It's not about housing, but it's a service targeted at a couple groups that that are on general assistance. They have a disability or they are older and maybe homeless, or people who are eligible for group residential housing, but they're living in other settings. And again, it's this population that needs some additional supports to stabilize their housing through services. It's coordinating those services. It's tenancy supports. Perhaps they have some difficulty in gaining access to affordable housing. Perhaps they have some difficulty with their landlord that can be more effective with some additional communication. So it's how do we help people be successful in stabilizing their housing through this service? We know by evidence, we know by research, that if we are successful with more people, we drive down their healthcare costs substantially, and we have the data to support that, the statistics to support that, to really stabilize their lives. And we can provide more information in the data if you wish. I'm going to turn to...
Okay, well, in just a moment, Assistant Commissioner, I just wanted to mention that in the reform, as we move towards, just as we did with the institutionalized mentally ill and move to community-based services, one of the crises we created was the failure to have adequate services in the community to really respond. So there were huge gaps in services for people, and it's taken a long time, and we have not yet completely resolved that issue. But I want us to be more deliberate about that when we're moving people from highly intensive care systems that do not need them. If we change, for example, the eligibility for nursing home care, tighten that up so that they have many, many more problems before they can access there, and so they become eligible then for a different set of programs, that if they have taken down their assets, their resources, in order to be housed in assisted living, and we're moving them back out of that because we changed that criteria, that this housing issue and stable resource for where the person can be and live be a part of the solution here, so that it simply isn't a moving out of one costly system into services but no place to reside. So it's just a comment I want you to think about.
Very good. Madam Chair, I think you'll see as we move through some of the budget initiatives that we have identified that there are groups of people that need more support than we're currently able to provide, and we've tried to take a very planful way to build that additional support for people with complex needs.
It's because we often look at our budget in relationship to the section that we're paying for. And in order to do the cost savings, because we know people don't need a certain medical service at a certain level, and lower them, but then there's other social support systems that aren't, that we have to integrate our thinking about that and not repeat what we did with the mental health system. Okay, thank you very much. And I'll move to.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Assistant Commissioner David Hartford.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. I will just build on what Commissioner Coleman has said to date, because really his concepts around Reform 2020 are applicable to the continuum for mental health care, and we also have projects that cross over between the two administrations. And just to address, Minnesota has done much to accomplish along the road to community-based continuum of care. We're really a model nationally for implementation of evidence-based practice, the Mental Health Action Group back in 2005, along with the governor's initiative in 2007, really set the stage for model benefit sets here in Minnesota. And we've been on this road, as you were speaking to, Madam Chair, just a second ago, about the deinstitutionalization and putting many services, evidence-based practice, many services in the community. And we've done well at many of those things. And all of them really driving towards the triple aim of healthcare: reducing costs while improving patient experience, while improving health outcomes. But there's still a long way to go. And we know that from the work that we've done, continuous improvement, what are the things that we need to continue to improve? And we're going to accomplish our goals through, one, modifying our existing services, the good work that we've done already, providing new services to targeted groups, and also testing new and innovative approaches. As we presented the waiver, some of the waiver information, the federal waiver that we have, several projects are crossovers. One I'll speak to here is Anoka Regional Treatment Center. As we evolved our mental health system and more services to the community, that institution also evolved, as Commissioner Coleman said, from a 200-bed facility to a tertiary care statewide resource with specialty services, moved away from institutional care to a facility that now provides specialty mental health care. The non-acute bed days, or it's being utilized, we don't have enough services in the community. Kind of back to the point that you were making. We know that we've got gaps in our community services, and that's a lot of the Reform 2020 efforts are moving towards what are the things that we need to do to make those adjustments to have the system work as a whole. So that's one of the components of Reform 2020 is a request to have the IMD status removed from Anoka Regional Treatment Center. Currently, that means that all of the care provided at that facility is 100% state share. And by having that waived, we will not only improve our throughput, but also financially serve dollars. We would get the matching dollars to help, again, expand our services, give specialty services of what people need in the community. That's one aspect of the federal waiver. The other crossover piece is what is referred to as the PATH CTI, which is really a PATH, the name for it is the Project for Assistance in Transition from Homelessness. That's really a SAMHSA grant that's existing, and we're looking to, as part of the waiver, to combine that with what's called critical time incident. That is an evidence-based practice nationally. Those interventions, we're looking at combining them with the PATH grant and as a demonstration in targeted communities around the state, improve services for, and again, this is aimed at people who are homeless or at risk of homeless and also mentally ill or mentally ill and chemically dependent. So that's, again, part of that federal waiver. On the next slide in your packet, other areas of Reform 2020, because some are part of the waiver, some not, this other grouping is legislative proposals that we currently have. And again, looking at adjustments to the system. The first, to establish a clinical care coordination benefit. This is a new service, and what it gets to is that we know we get better outcomes when clinicians talk to each other and coordinate care. This really gets to reimbursing clinicians for those clinical consultations when they take the time, so we support them and encourage them to make those coordinated efforts. The second item, to expand adult rehabilitation mental health services and adjust the rates. This is a foundational service in the community, and we've been losing our providers. Our rates were set at a place that the providers can't stay in business. We've lost more than 10% of our providers, and we continue to lose providers. So this is twofold. One is to get a rate adjustment so that our valuable providers stay in business, And the second piece is to add some additional services that were not in the original package that are, again, like getting functional assessments and a couple of other services in there. And we know that data says that this reduces these services when done in the community, reduce inpatient hospitalizations. Third, we're looking to establish a mental health special treatment service. Again, this is a new service for a targeted group. One of the things that as we built our new system, we have identified we've got a gap for people with really complex needs that are leaving hospitals. They no longer meet hospital level of that medically managed care, but they're also their needs are too complex to move to our existing community-based residential service, so we've got a gap there. So this is really about creating a new medically monitored service for these individuals so they can get out of inpatient, because you always move up in intensity. If somebody can't meet the one level, it's kind of some of the conversation we had earlier, then they stay in the hospital too long. So this is really to address a step down out of our hospitals. The fourth is an expansion of mental health crisis response services. This is about mobile crisis teams, both for children and adults, so that the only place to get service is not the emergency room. We know this is an effective service done in communities across the state. There are 59 counties currently being served by this service for children, 49 counties for adults in one tribe. We're looking at adding some support for infrastructure costs to get the team started, looking at four additional teams that will cover an additional 16 counties and two tribes. And then lastly, we're looking to expand our school link grants. Again, this is another successful innovation. We're looking to double our capacity, moving from 17 school districts to 35 districts in the state. And again, this is a gap. These are reimbursed services. This is creating the linkage between schools and mental health professionals. And we've demonstrated through this that children get earlier access. Communities of color are even more impacted by having this service available, that they're able to access mental health care.
Madam Chair. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Hartford, the school link grants, are those, and you're expanding those, are they primarily in the metro area, or do you have some in other areas where there are some diversity, such as Rochester, Worthington, Wilmer?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, it is distributed around the state. I believe there are some metro school districts that don't have the service today, but we're really targeting across the state and doubling that capacity. And I'll add one other point to this that will give us the coverage that we have. That's kind of we're at capacity, even though there are many more school districts across the state. We've done an analysis and finding we actually don't have the mental health workforce across the state to expand, even if we were we have to address workforce issues if we want to expand it beyond these 35 school districts.
So, Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Rosen.
So what is the department in the workforce development? What are we doing about that issue? Has there been a concerted effort to expand the program? Do you know? I mean, it would be interesting to get a little more information about what are the limitations on that educational component?
Well, did you want to respond to that question? I know that this issue of training professionals, redeveloping the professional workforce I thought it was in some of the Health and Human Services budgets, but maybe I'm seeing it someplace else in the higher ed budget. But we've also heard presentation about developing a diverse workforce that the persons who are working with these populations are looking through lenses that reflect the communities that are being treated instead of through our lens all the time, through the Western lens. So, but, you know, maybe we can just chase that down a little bit for our committee.
Yeah, please.
Mm-hmm. This is a barrier. You can expand this school link program where you bring psychologists or advanced practice nurses into the school to work with teachers or with counselors, but you can only, but you funded this, I think you're saying that the expansion plan right now is related to what you know the workforce capacity is, that you could do more, we might do more if we could afford it, if we had more providers. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Okay.
Thank you.
And with that, I'll turn it back to Commissioner.
Thank you.
Assistant
Commissioner Coleman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Let me conclude.
Excuse me, before you, I did not see Senator Nelson has a question before we move forward.
Thank you for letting me get this in before we change topics here. I'm wondering if you could give me a little more information on the clinical care coordination benefit. I was just visiting with the executive director at the Zumbro Valley Mental Health, and I'd like to know a little bit more about this. What would that cover, and how would that be beneficial, and how would that be rolled out across the state?
Madam Chair.
Assistant Commissioner.
Senator Nelson. I don't have the details on a rollout for it. I mean, the concept is there, and it's basically I can get you more information around it, but it's really around just creating an additional benefit so that providers, it would be one, like a service code, that they could bill for that time spent. Because currently, providers may all of that, they would like to have a half-hour consultation with another professional, that there's no reimbursement through their day for that kind of work. So this is really a benefit we're establishing to help support quality time and recognize that that's a valuable part of the care that individuals receive, is that consultation, that we're going to coordinate that their efforts.
I'll follow up at home on that issue then. Thank you.
Just to follow up on that, you're talking about it as an additional benefit, but is the concept of coordinated care or healthcare homes being applied to this system so that there is in a formula for reimbursement time to meet and have a conversation where, you know, when you pass a person through the system and it goes from one person to another depending on their level of need, and you don't have time built in there for, or because you're not reimbursed for it, for communications or even for sending electronic medical records. None of that is reimbursable. But is the system going to be just to allow for a charge, like a coding for a charge for this, or is this going to be developed in a more comprehensive way of managing care?
Madam Chair, there's a lot of, as was referenced earlier, a lot of Reform 2020 efforts or ongoing efforts, let's say around behavioral health home, navigator concepts. There's a lot of other planning going on. There are work groups currently meeting around, let's say, behavioral health homes. This particular proposal is just around that benefit, so a provider can get reimbursed for that time spent. But there's many more planning efforts that are really, you'll see at another time as these ideas become more evolved, efforts around coordination of care from more of a system standpoint and how are medical records managed, those kinds of things, I think you'll see in the future.
Yeah, thanks. I'll be interested in that because I think to have this just be a fee for a service and it's a quoted, it could be hugely expensive unless we build it into a comprehensive healthcare home kind of system model. Because I know the Mayo Clinic does a lot of consultation, I don't know how they build that into their reimbursement, but okay, continue, please. I may be leaving the committee a little early, so if you see me step up and go out, it's not because of your presentation.
Chair, members of the committee, I'll conclude with slides 15 and 16, which gives you some examples of additional initiatives. Most are not part of the formal 1115 waiver to the federal government, but they are they're strategies that support where we want to get to by 2020. The first, though, the innovative approaches to service coordination, is part of the waiver application of the federal government, and this one is not defined because we're taking a different approach, saying for children on the community first services and supports, we're not going to tell communities how to coordinate those services. This would be managed through an RFP process where we're actually asking communities, integrated communities, the counties, the schools, the providers, families to come together and propose to us how they will demonstrate an innovative approach to supporting children, including the community first service and support services. Trying to recognize that children have a broader range of needs. We're only part of their lives, an important part, but not the whole life. So this we're not predefining. We're actually going to ask communities to define this for us, and then we will evaluate the best approaches. The other elements on slide 15 are additional initiatives. They don't require federal approval. They're strategies to try to improve coordination, improve the integration. On slide 16 are some additional initiatives that, again, I want to just make note of for the committee. The nursing facility level of care implementation, which was referenced earlier, and this will be implemented January 1, 2014, where we are raising the criteria, changing the criteria by which one becomes eligible for the nursing facility benefit as well as the waiver services. We have provider standards, which are was part passed last year. We have to come forward again with additional standards this year. The short version of that is counties will no longer be contracting with providers directly. It has to be held by the state in terms of contracting with providers. And so we need standards built in. What are the criteria by which we will license providers, evaluate them, monitor their services? Rate methodologies for waiver services, we have some of those complete. We have some that are yet to be brought before you. It, again, was an initiative from last year, and we've been working with stakeholders, and that will be of interest to many. Redesigning the fiscal support entities, again, making that more efficient. We want to make it as functional as possible for consumers to manage their own services, hire their own caregivers, manage their package of services as a decision maker. So we want to simplify that. And then a small but certainly very important to individuals who are ventilator dependent, who wish to live in the community, to eliminate the requirement that they enter a nursing facility for 30 days in order to get a sufficient amount of resources in the elderly waiver to be able to live in the community. So again, a sampling of related reform activities, but not part of the formal application to the federal government. And I'll pause for any further questions.
Members have any questions? Senator Sharon had to leave, but if there are more questions, I'd like to have you have an opportunity to ask them. Pardon my cold. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for coming today and presenting to us. And that's the last item on the agenda, so I will consider the meeting adjourned. Thank you.